Hi, I'm Chuck Elkins, Executive Director of the EPA Alumni Association. Today we're talking to David Dominick in his office in Cody, Wyoming. David was the Commissioner of Federal Water Pollution Control Administration in the Department of the Interior in the late 1960s. In that capacity, he was instrumental in bringing about a great strengthening of the federal water pollution control authorities. Specifically, he worked with President Nixon to greatly increase the money available for sewage treatment plant grants, up to $4.1 billion over a several-year period. Secondly, he drafted a new water quality bill, which was sent to Congress and enacted after the water pollution program moved into the new agency in 1972. In the new agency, the president asked David to become the assistant administrator for categorical programs, that is, all the programs in the agency other than air and water. David, we're happy to talk to you today about those early days leading up to the creation of EPA.
It's a pleasure to be here. We'll just have a conversation. It may wander all over the place, but there's a lot of reminiscing to be done about those days we had there in Washington, D.C., and what experiences we had, and some tough times, some being totally scared about this or that and coming through it and whatnot. So we'll just start off by saying that being raised here in Wyoming and being raised in a great wide open country and being interested in the environment from the beginning because of what we have in this state. And the birding activity that I always got into very early. My mother gave me this wonderful bird book by Roger Torrey Peterson. It's all battered up here. A Field Guide to Western Birds by Peterson. To David, May of 1948. To keep up your growing interest in birds and nature, love from mother and daddy. Here it is. The first plate is the jays and crows. So we'll do a little jays and crows activity. Growing up here, that was it was a great place to be. At the age of, I think I was maybe 12. I drew a sheep license, a mountain sheep license, to hunt a mountain sheep at the age of 12, of all things. And after hunting over there in the Grable River on many, many weekends, my father was a doctor and we could only get off on weekends, finally killed a ram, the only ram we saw the entire fall. And that was a big deal for a kid from Wyoming. So that's sort of in the background. And we've had some wonderful people to be associated with here. Old Millward Simpson here in Cody. And he was in the Senate. And he allowed me to come back and be a summer intern. And that's what got me to Washington in the first place. I'd been in the Marine Corps. And speaking of the Marine Corps, I really think that that experience in the Marine Corps gave me some of a capacity to leadership. I was awarded the sword at basic school because of I was awarded the top graduate there at basic school in Quantico, Virginia. And we had a very, very interesting tour overseas. Our battalion missed Vietnam by 3 months. We were on our way back before we put people into Vietnam. I'd been promoted to battalion adjutant by our county, our battalion commander. And so the Marine Corps itself was really a very good beginning in terms of gaining some confidence and being able to speak in public and things like that. And I hark back to that because of what a fine part of, what a fine opportunity actually that I had. I will mention here at the outset that when I went back to graduate school at Utah State, at an old age, but it was in my 60s at least, and I went to graduate school for a graduate degree, and I was the oldest person in that group, of course, and it took me, I think it took me 3 years to get through it. The other kids got whizzed right through it with their thesis in a two, but it took me 3 years to write up the experience that I had in Washington, which is here, the Nixon Environmental Agenda, An Insider's View of Republican Decision-Making, 1968 to 1973. And in that thesis, I was really able to bear down and to really give a first person progress of what we had accomplished in those very early days. So here we are in Washington. Millward Simpson had to retire because he was diagnosed with Parkinson's by my father, who was his doctor here in Cody. Cliff Hansen was elected in his place. In any event, the presidential election came up, and had the election been, I think, 6 days earlier, all the polls showed that Nixon's opponent, Lyndon Johnson's vice president, may have won, but it turned out that Nixon won by a hairbreadth, and that began his first term. And because of the fact that Cliff Hansen was the junior member on the Senate Interior Committee, minority junior member, he was told to send down somebody to the new executive office building during the transition between the election of Nixon and his inauguration. And the purpose of that was to go through what they called the plum book, which was to fire all of the persons who were not totally protected by the civil service, all the super grades and whatnot in the prior administration, and go through all these resumes and pick people that could be inserted into the new administration. And that was an experience and a half, because here you were in this Warren, in the new executive office building, with all of these characters. Everybody had a cubicle, and they were going through the what they called the plum books, and picking out the particular positions in the various departments of government, and looking at all of the resumes that had come in from people who were aspiring to become something of a feature in Washington, D.C., and hiring them for the coming administration. So here was John Dean and Jeb Magruder and Chuck Colson and John Mitchell, the whole gang of these guys. Every one of them was closeted in their own little cubicle. Not a one of them would look you in the eye. The exception was John Warner, and he was young at the time. He had been in the Navy. I think he was a captain in the Navy, and this was before he married Elizabeth Taylor. And he was really a very fine gentleman, and we got to talking and had a good time with each other. And so here we are, and Wally Hickel was nominated by the president, as you know, to become the first Secretary of the Interior. The old tradition was that somebody from the West always filled that interior post. And he's a wonderful guy, you know, just with the bark on, one of those self-made men. According to his tall tales, he said he went to Alaska with 10 cents in his pocket and started in Alaska. He became a very prominent, very successful builder in Alaska, of shopping centers and all of that in Anchorage. Interestingly enough, he lived through the great earthquake that occurred during his time as governor of Alaska, which wreaked havoc in Anchorage. And following all of the breakdown of various buildings and whatnot, typical Hickel, built a fine hotel, many-storied hotel, the tallest building in Alaska, which was his response to what nature was going to do. So it gives you some idea of what kind of a character he was. And so Wally Hickel comes to town, and he is flown in from Alaska, from Anchorage, but he arrives after being up all night long on a midnight special coming down from Alaska. And he comes up to the fourth floor of the executive building, and I am told, well, Dominic, you better get out there and talk to Governor Hickel, because he has a press interview over there at the interior building in about 15 minutes, and you better give him a little briefing as to what he should expect. So he comes off the elevator, and I'm standing there, and I say, Governor, my name is such and so, and they've got you slated for this briefing over there at the interior building, the main floor, that great big main floor with the press, and maybe I could give you some ideas about what they would be talking to you about and asking you about and getting into. And he says, well, God damn it, can't you see that I need a shave? And he ducks into the men's room, and he comes out and he goes down over to the interior building, and he gives this first press conference, and he just has a wonderful time. He thinks he's having a good time because he keeps talking about my country in Alaska. Well, in my country, you know, we don't have an awful lot of these regulations that you people have got down here, and you know, you talk about trees, we've got more trees in Alaska than we need in a long, long time. And when we have something we need to take care of, such as the Russians coming across across the boundary, off the open seas into the inland part there, I just got my Alaskan police force, and we got in a boat, we went out and arrested them. And that's what the kind of things we do up in Alaska. So I don't know what you folks down here have in mind, but that's sort of where we're starting out. Well, boom, everything goes to hell in a hurry. The newspapers begin to pick it up, and Hickel is really in the soup. And so the White House people come over and they say, look, Dominic, you're from the West, and you were the one designated to talk to the secretary. He's going up for his confirmation hearings in January. That's right after the inauguration of Nixon, the next week after his inauguration, in front of the Senate Interior Committee. And the Interior Committee is run at that time. Senior member is that wonderful guy from Washington, and the Democrats controlled the Senate, and Cliff Hedson, being the junior member on that committee, was also on the committee during the time that he was being discussed, and his nomination was being really vetted by the Interior Committee. And he had to answer a lot of tough questions, and I was helpful to him, I hope, in suggesting what might be coming his way about the various issues, and it went quite well. Indeed, on the almost the final day of the hearing, he would actually it was a really tough time for him because he would be appearing at 9 or 9:30 each morning. They'd break for lunch. He would return to the Sheraton Hotel on Connecticut Avenue, where he and all of his people from Alaska were, and he'd take a shower and clean himself up and go back for the afternoon. And finally, Frank Church, on the third day of the grilling that he was getting, simply leaned over the podium and he said, "Governor, I don't think they've laid a hand on you." And he was referring to the fact that Hickel was known for having won the Golden Gloves Championship when he was in eighth grade, way back in Kansas, all part of Hickel's wonderful background and really quite an interesting fellow that he was. And so that was the beginning. And because they had asked me to do the briefings for him, he sort of decided, well, I'll take Dominic along on some of these things that are coming up. And the first thing that came up, even before he was finally sworn in, actually, was the blowout of the wells there on the Santa Barbara Channel. And the well had blown out. The reason it blew out is because the operators had removed the downhole chokes. The downhole choke is put at the bottom of the well bore to prevent any oil or pressure from getting to the top. They'd removed the downhole choke in order to get better drilling done, and the thing blew up, and the chairman of that company, Fred Hartley, was there on the beach as we landed, Hickel, myself, and Bill Pecora, and we stood there on the beach. The oil was slapping up against the beaches of Santa Barbara, which is a very high-end real estate place, a lot of wealth along there, and making a horrible mess. So there we are, and Eddie Weinberg, who was in the solicitor department at the Interior Department, had gone along with us. And we stood there, and Hickel said, "All right, the only way we're going to stop this is I'm going to shut you down," saying to Fred Hartley, who was also a maverick. I mean, he uneducated in terms of any college or anything like that, but a real freelance fellow. And Eddie Weinberg just began to jump up and down in the sand and say, Mr. Secretary, you can't do that. They have a lease. They have a lease and they have a right. And so Fred Hartley just turns to Hickel and he says, "Well, Wally, we're shutting her down. We're shutting it down." And that was a great, great moment. And just reflected what kind of a person he was. So the fact that I just had that experience with that fellow, and that sort of segued into the fact that when he was trying to set up his department in Interior, he decided to tap me to run the Federal Water Pollution Control Administration. It had a different name at the time, but that was the name that we finally put onto it before much legislation had gone forward. Here's this cartoon by Herblock. And Herblock was the cartoonist for the Washington Post. And when Hickel first arrived, there's a wonderful cartoon about Hickel and his confirmation hearings. As I mentioned, when he went up in front of the Senate Interior Committee, he was really fighting an impression that he had left with his first encounter with the press, that he was this renegade from Alaska who really was out of sync with everything else and was a total disaster as far as Nixon's appointees were concerned. And Herblock's first cartoon showed the 11 members of the cabinet, all of the 11 department members, from justice to HEW and whatnot, all well put together and all marching in a row. And Herblock's cartoon had Hickel at the back of that march in his cartoon, back there pulling up his pants. And lo and behold, Hickel's performance and Hickel's commitment was such that the last Herblock cartoon, this one here that I've held up, shows a gentleman saying, "I told him I thought I could serve him best by serving all the people," and this gentleman writing down, being a correspondent, and there is Hickel holding his head underneath his shoulder. His head had been cut off. Pretty dramatic cartoon. You will recall the Kent State shootings. You will recall the uprising among the youth about Vietnam. You will recall where we were in the Vietnam War at the time, and the fact that that war was going nowhere, that we were not winning in any sense of the word, that when we tried to go into North Vietnam and Nixon ordered the bombing of Hanoi, that the war simply did not turn in our favor. And so Vietnam and Nixon's being saddled with that war was really a terrific part of that era. And Wally Hickel believed that if we reached out to the youth of America, if we reached out to the better instincts of America, if we reached out to those who felt about conservation, that it would be an important way to perhaps turn public policy around on that issue. And Hickel had the idea that if he could have help from that sector of our population, from the youth and from good people, that it would really make a difference. And so when the Kent State shootings occurred, we had the march on Washington from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young people coming in by buses from all over the country to come to Washington, D.C. And many of these people gathered around at the Washington Monument. And as they did so, they demanded the flags that flew all around the Washington Monument, as you know, be lowered to half mast. And they did lower the flags to half mast, at which point the National Police, which happened to come from the Department of the Interior, ironically, the National Police for the monuments, etc., on horseback, came back out and started clubbing these kids over the head and insisting that the flags be put back up to full mast. And that was an incident because they had just began to squash that public outcry. And so here was Hickel in his office with me and with Bill Pecora at the time that that was going on. These kids have got banged up. Hickel wanted to make sure that there was a way they could get down to the Department of HEW where they could be treated for being, you know, somewhat hit upon. And we tried to make some adjustments for that. And we were sitting there in the big office that had originated by Harold Ickes when he first started the Department of the Interior. And Hickel was standing at his desk, and Bill Pecora and I were standing there next to him. And Hickel had written a letter to the president. Actually, it had been somewhat edited by a young White House fellow that had been assigned from the White House to come into the Department of the Interior and learn how government worked. Well, this fellow had helped Hickel write this letter, which suggested that we pay attention to the youth, that we pay attention to dissent, that we understand the reason for the turmoil that was going on in the country at the time, affected by Vietnam, etc. And he had written this letter as a personal letter to the president. And we were standing there, and the phone call came into Hickel's office, and Hickel picked it up, directly picked it up. He didn't have a lot of secretaries around. He had no big entourage surround him. He was pretty much you know, on his own. Carl McMurray was his best confidant. Carl McMurray kept himself in the background. And here we were, and the phone rings, and Hickel picks up the phone, and it's John Ehrlichman on the phone. And John Ehrlichman says, "Mr. Secretary, we have not received your letter, but your letter has just been published in the Washington Times, and we have just received this newspaper." And bang, Hickel just sat down and just almost wilted, because the letter had made suggestions to the president that he open up, that he respect the youth, that he recognize the turmoil that was going on. It was a well-constructed letter. And that letter and that exposure was the end of Wally Hickel as far as Secretary of the Interior was concerned. He was not fired at the time. Nixon kept him on until just before Thanksgiving. And at Thanksgiving, Nixon, through Ehrlichman, told Hickel that he was not to go out on the mall. Hickel always had a limousine that took him to his home, that he was to go down in the elevator from his big office there to his car and take him home. And that was, he was, you know, ordered not to get out into the public. And that really was the downfall of Hickel. So that is that story. And so here I am. I've just turned 33, I think, or maybe 34, I'm not sure. And here is this agency with 3,000 different civil employees. I'm the only nominated person in that agency. Everyone else is there, protected by civil service, of course. We had 9 different regional offices. We had laboratories that were scattered across the United States. Laboratories, frankly, that all appeared in states or cities. Enid, Oklahoma, for instance, which was the home ground of some politician in the Senate or in the House that maneuvered the location of these kinds of things. And so I have to step into the seat there. And our office was over in what they call Crystal City, which was across the Potomac from downtown Washington. And I think we were up on about the fifth floor. And so I have this big office looking out over the airport there and across the Potomac, and sitting at this big desk. And the question is, well, now what are you going to do? So we just started in introducing myself to the various employees there. David Steffen was the assistant commissioner for research and development. Another guy was assistant commissioner for operations. Another guy was assistant commissioner for administration, and then one fellow for enforcement. But the fact of the matter was that there was some speculation that this was going to be a disaster, that this kid from Wyoming who knew nothing from nothing was going to have to run this agency with a tremendous number of people, all protected by the civil service. And that's how it got started. And I was able to select somebody to, well, actually my deputy commissioner was a long-term fine civil servant. We accomplished a great deal there in our early years. Of course, we wrote the Clean Water Act. I was able to organize the agency with people that I could trust. And we used the MITRE Corporation at my behest. It was a not-for-profit corporation, which two experts came into the agency and spent about just 6 weeks there in the conference room writing our first version of the Clean Water Act. And the only problem that we ran up against immediately was the fact that in the Interior Department, the assistant secretary in the Interior Department, guy by the name of Carl Klein, had a section of activity in the Interior Department that covered water pollution and one other minor thing. And the water pollution happened to be our agency. So here, Carl Klein had little more to do than to try to make his way as the assistant secretary on how we were going to run things at the Federal Water Pollution Control Administration. And he quickly made himself known. He came across the river, across the Potomac, into my shop, looked around, began to interview people and whatnot. The long and the short of it was that he fired, outright fired my deputy commissioner, a longtime civil servant who had served very well, and inserted in that position a political hack from the Senate Senatorial Committee. Klein insisted that this fellow would be my deputy. And at that point, I said, well, I don't think this is going to work. And I decided to go across the river and talk to Wally Hickel about this incident. And I was prepared to offer my resignation. Well, we did that. I went across and had a short talk with Wally Hickel, and then he referred me to Carl McMurray, who was his inside man. Carl had come down with Hickel from Alaska. And of the staff that Hickel had assembled around him there, Carl McMurray was really the top dog. He kept himself in the background. His name was not known in terms of meeting with the press and things like that, but he was really Hickel's right-hand man. And McMurray convinced me to stay on, and he said that we would work this out with Klein. And that is sort of how the whole shebang started. Murray Stein was one of the assistant commissioners for enforcement. He had one assistant and a secretary. All these other assistant commissioners, you know, built a big bureaucracy around them. Murray Stein was a single-handed character who would hold what he called enforcement conferences. They were conferences because it was a matter of bringing in, we'll just take an example of going to the Great Lakes, for instance, and establishing a conference up there in one of the key towns bordering the Great Lakes. And he would get a hotel or get a forum. He'd sit up front, and he would call various state people involved in water pollution before him to testify as to what they were doing. And he would then come back to town, back to Washington, and they would write up a summary of what testimony had been given. But the problem was that he only could influence pollution control on streams that had more than one state. In other words, that was interstate in its distribution. And that I believe, I may be a little off on the legal part of this, but that really restrained the amount of activity that he could present that was truly enforceable. For instance, we had a conference on the Cuyahoga River, which had caught on fire in as it flowed through the city of Cleveland into the Erie, Lake Erie, and it was not an interstate occurrence. So there was no actual restrictions and enforceable activity that would come out of such a conference. Nevertheless, we went down to Texas, to the Houston Ship Channel. The same thing happened there. The Houston Ship Channel was probably the dirtiest piece of water in the entire country, with all of these oil refineries and other other companies simply dumping their waste into the Houston Ship Channel, where it flowed out into the Gallatin Peninsula. And so it was the enforcement activity that was available to us at that time, before the writing of the Clean Water Act, was difficult and in some cases de minimis. We held a conference on Lake Superior, for instance, and one of the big issues up there was the reserve mining case on Lake Superior, and the case involved this taconite operation, mining of taconite, which is a low grade of coal, as I understood it, with a very big operation on the western shore of Lake Superior. And they were dumping the tailings of the taconite products directly into Lake Superior and polluting Lake Superior and affecting the fish population. And that was one of the first enforcement conferences that Murray Stein had executed when I first got there. He would select witnesses. He would call for the witnesses to come and appear before his table. These conferences would be in a big room, and he would then question these witnesses who were representing the Reserve Mining Company. They had a very sharp lawyer up there, and he really was making his entire living protecting the Reserve Mining Company, and he would seek testimony as to what they were doing, what the effect of what they were doing was, but we had no way of really, we didn't have the capacity, I don't think, to get a lot of experts in the field to simply monitor the amount of pollution that was occurring. So it was not a very well put together enforcement scheme, yet it was the only scheme that Murray Stein had at his disposal. And he would go about the country looking for opportunities to have these conferences. And that was my understanding of where we stood with the law at the time. In this case, this was an industrial discharge. And sewage treatment plants, depending upon how much money a city, such as the city of Washington or the city of Des Moines or Chicago or whatever it may be, had committed to treatment facilities. And there was something called primary treatment, which really was a group of settling ponds. The effluent would be put into settling ponds. Some of it, some of the contaminants would drop out from that. And if they didn't have the money or the will or the political clout to upgrade this to so-called secondary treatment, it would go in to the waterway. That was the difficulty that we were facing with the law at that time. But it is all mostly city government and city budgets, city politics, et cetera, that was dictating that particular public works activity. Public works being building of roads or bridges and whatnot. The Eisenhower administration, that one of its signature successes was the building of the interstate highway across the country. And in terms of comparative things, what was being done for water pollution control or cleanup or awareness, we were really behind the eight ball at that point as we started out administration. The legislation that was finally passed, the Clean Water Act, which we developed in our agency, was designed to give authority for cleanup in interstate situations, and the money. I mean, that it really was the money that that we were able to get. Number one through OMB, number two through the president, number three through the Congress, when the big discussions at the time, the big trips that I took across the river to be with Wally Hickel when we went into OMB was to try to convince the administration to come up with water pollution control funds that would be then distributed to cities for this cleanup. We were opposed in our proposals by the Commerce Department, who was then headed up by the man. He had been the chairman of the Nixon re-election or the Nixon election program, Maurice Stans. So commerce being what it was, its patron was the industry of the country, was very much opposed to our big push for water cleanup and appropriations. And Wally Hickel was really at his finest in supporting us there. We got into the billions of dollars, and we got there because Wally Hickel was so persistent. The early comeback was for $560 million or something of that sort. And Hickel's remark to that was, this is such a small amount. This is just enough to maybe give a couple of babies in a bathtub a good scrubbing. And we need to go far beyond that. And we got it up to a remarkable level of appropriations. And it was that, frankly, it was that very process which allowed us to then, as a strong agency, give these monies to municipalities, which then in turn brought their sewage treatment systems up to snuff. And the long and the short of it was that we finally got authority to put into the appropriations legislation up to $4 billion stretched over a considerable period of time. So one of the major pushes, I think, and really historically in terms of, you know, all of the other activity that FWPCA might have been involved with, I think one of the major activities that we were totally focused with and made a difference was that appropriation for water treatment. Ehrlichman was our secret weapon, I think, in terms of environmental matters, because Ehrlichman did have an interest in the environment. He had some connections with various projects when he first was back in the state of Washington, where he came from. He was a lawyer there before he came into the administration. And, you know, getting something through OMB, getting our appropriations with the great increases, et cetera, that we were looking for, OMB would make its decisions and send recommendations over to the president himself. It turned out that Nixon obviously was getting himself mired into Watergate, and it turned out that Ehrlichman took it upon himself to simply shortcut some of these instances of recommendations or problems or memorandum that had anything to do with cutting back on environmental quality, and I was made aware of that somewhat by seeing a couple of instances of something that we were trying to put forward came through, made it through the OMB process, and we were able to get something done. I was personally made aware of that, and I was made more aware of that when I did my interview with him when I was writing that thesis. Ehrlichman was one of the last people that I was able to interview by phone during that thesis, and he explained to me that on many, many items, particularly affecting our interest in the environment and that activity, he simply didn't pass on OMB's recommendations or non-recommendations to the president. He just acted upon it and said, okay, that's we'll go with that program, which was an interesting revelation that I was able to have in my conversations with John Ehrlichman. And of course, Ehrlichman and Haldeman both got fired by Nixon prior to Watergate coming to a full head. Nixon and Ehrlichman told me about that incident when Watergate blew up. Nixon was up at up at the retreat there in the Pennsylvania hills, and Ehrlichman said Nixon called up the office at the White House and ordered that Ehrlichman and Haldeman get in the helicopter and come up to Camp David. And Ehrlichman told me the story of that. He said, Ehrlichman sat on one side of the helicopter and I sat on the other. We never said a word to one another. He said, in essence, that he and Haldeman didn't have a whole lot of closeness to them, to each other. And they landed. They walked into Nixon's quarters. Nixon stood there. Nobody sat down. Nixon said, I have to tell you, gentlemen, that you are both fired. And that's how they got the axe. And then Watergate began to blow up. Myself and this other fellow from Wyoming went around the Congress trying to seek support for the pollution control measures that we were putting forward to the Congress. And Jim Watt was his name. And Jim Watt had left Senator Simpson's, Millward Simpson's office. Watt came from Wyoming and was Millward Simpson's first administrative assistant. And Jim Watt had left there and had gone to work at the outfit there in Washington, the business-oriented outfit. And Jim Watt, at that point, was operating as a lobbyist and lobbied against our appropriation for clean water, which is another story. But Watt and I went to see Ed Muskie, and Muskie literally didn't physically throw him out of the office, but Muskie told him to get the hell out of his office because of Jim Watt's activity. Became Secretary of the Interior, and that was under the other president's watch. And he, as Secretary of the Interior, was Watt went through a number of religious different machinations and became a sort of a born-again Christian, I think. And when Watt was Secretary of the Interior, he ordered that none of his female employees were allowed to come to work in anything but a skirt. And all hell broke out at the Interior Department when he was Secretary of the Interior. And he eventually simply was fired because of that, but that's a whole nother story. After that bad introduction to Muskie's staff with Jim Watt and myself, Watt got out of the picture, and I really had a very good relationship with Senator Muskie and his staff. His staff was, he just had two staffers who were really damn good people, hard-nosed people. And as we began to put our program together and look for these appropriations, my relationship with Ed Muskie personally was very good. And when both Bob Fry and I were nominated by the president to go into EPA, these were presidential appointments, both went to Ed Muskie's office and presented ourselves to him. And Ed Muskie held our confirmation hearings in his He was on the Public Works Committee. Our confirmation went in front of Muskie, and Muskie became a pretty good friend, actually. And I watched with some sadness when he was running for the presidency, as you may recall. And he was in New Hampshire. Carl Loeb ran that newspaper in New Hampshire. And Carl Loeb, Muskie was on a platform, on a flatbed truck, I think, and was talking to a crowd. And Carl Loeb had just published in his newspaper, he controlled the newspapers there in New Hampshire, the fact that Muskie's wife had come from Canada and was a Canuck. I called her a Canuck in this editorial. And it was not true. And Muskie, when he read that, frankly, just simply broke down. He just broke down in tears and had to get off the podium. It was the end of his campaign to become considered for the presidency. You know, the old Corvette problem that Ralph Nader originally landed on, and all of the auto industry, was how he got his start. And Ralph Nader decided that water pollution control was another one of his targets. And he assembled a group, and I've got their books right here. Their books are that thick. A young group, David Zwick was his agent to set up that group, that came into our agency, and they spent 15 months in FWPCA investigating every part of our operation and recording their investigations, recording where the weaknesses were, recording what results had been achieved, recording what inaction had brought to the situation, recording to the inattention of big industry, be it oil and gas, be it paper production, be it whatnot, around the country. It was a very, very interesting effort. They had young, bright, all graduate student people. They had a team of about 15 different people that were in our agency for a year and a half, and their product is here in my library. And that was another problem that Carl Klein had, because he insisted that one of his agents, one of the people that he had over there at Interior, would sit in on Ralph Nader's investigations. David Zwick was handling all of the various people. And it took me, I think I had to go all the way to Wally Hickel to get Klein to take his people out of there, because I was very much in favor of the Nader activity. And that was reflected, frankly, in some of Nader's personal comments that he put in the various collection of books that were put out, that that I had been apparently cooperative and seemed to be, I guess, an all-around Joe as far as getting this thing done. So that was a nice side effect. It was right straight down the pipe as far as I was concerned personally, and straight down the pipe as far as spreading good information to the general public and to the voices in the country that had some clout, be it in legislatures, be it in various organizational outfits, being it in public health, etc. The Nader effort there was very, very helpful. And there again, you had Carl Klein having an absolute fit when they came in, and he sent over couple of his people to sit in on all of their interviewings of my people. And I finally, as I may have mentioned earlier, I finally got that stopped and let Nader's people, who were bright as the Dickens, you know, do what they needed to do to find out what the facts were. As I may have mentioned, one of the first things I did when I got back to Washington was to join the Environmental Defense Fund and give them a contribution. The Environmental Defense Fund was started down there on the ocean side of Long Island, and it was started because of DDT appearing in the waterways there with bald eagles dying, etc. And the natural, what's happening in the natural environment because of this pollution was one of the factors that you know, would give us the oomph to get up and do something about it. The environmental movement was really beginning to move into the culture of our country at that time. And Environmental Defense Fund was one of the very first. And they were first stationed there in Long Island, as I say. Then they brought an office into Washington, and I was very close with one of the people that was very up in that organization. And I first personally gave quite a bit of contribution to that organization because, I mean, the connection between what was happening in the natural environment, what was happening to fish, what was happening to our bird life from this pollution was really the connection that we had to instill as an ethic in our population. And the number of environmental organizations that have sprung up since then, the Wyoming Outdoor Council, I mean, we've got enough organizations here in Cody, Wyoming, offices of different outfits, Sierra Club, everything else, that this is all part of a really a wonderful part of democracy, as far as I'm concerned.